song in the context of a certain political movement or social or cultural movement, and how it might or might not have become an anthem of that movement. Now, there's a song.
Okay, we can't go too much further because we're out of time, and that's Bill Valenti, you just heard, as well as Darka Dusty, Ukrainian-American singer, who will be at this event, The Art of the Protest Song, at the Rose City Book Pub on Saturday, November 5th. And I believe they said that you need to have a vaccination card to get in. Is that right?
They do have that requirement at the book pub. And okay. I think by now, pretty much everybody does.
Right. I just haven't been out and about too much. Anyway, that's it. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul, for inviting us.
All right. That's it for the show. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
This is Coast Strange Radio, a radio program of the Coast Strange Association. My name is Andrew Collins Anderson, and I am the host for Coast Strange Radio. Located in Western Oregon, the Coast Strange Association works to build just and sustainable communities that provide for people in the natural world. Our work focuses on the connections between Oregon's forests, communities, and the climate crisis. A better world is possible. To listen to past episodes and to learn more, visit coastrange.org or email me at andrew@coastrange.org. We hope everyone is doing well. Coast Range Radio is still doing interviews, and we are following best practices during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is our first phone interview, and we will be doing more in the future. On today's show, we are speaking with an excellent organizer and forest activist who is the Forest Defense Campaign Coordinator with the University of Oregon Climate Justice League and the field checking intern with Cascadia Wildlands. We are speaking with Courtney Kaltenbach. Hey, Courtney, thanks for joining us here at Coast Range Radio. What is the UO Climate Justice League and what do you all do?
Yeah, so the Climate Justice League is a student organization at the University of Oregon. They receive funds from the ASUO, which is the Finance and Government Association at the university. And our mission is basically to run campaigns that help combat climate injustice. And over the years, we've had many different campaigns in all different ways. We've had Take Back the Tap, which was all about installing water fountains in the university before they had that. We had a huge divest campaign around 3 years ago that was all about the university divesting from like natural gas investments. And right now we have two campaigns, and one is campus sustainability, which is working on making sure that our campus is held accountable to being sustainable and not just greenwashing. And then our other campaign is Forest Defense, which is the campaign that I help organize, which is all about trying to protect our public forests, especially since they're so important in sequestering carbon.
Great. So why have you decided to focus on forests and forest defense in your climate organizing and advocacy work?
Right, yes. So University of Oregon is a really interesting place as far as environmentalism goes, because you get this influx of students every year from all of these different places, nationally and internationally. And so it's really hard to kind of figure out like what you want to focus on as far as like how you want to make a difference. There's a lot of different programs on campus. And we decided to focus on forest defense because it is like the geographical makeup of like the areas around us. It's like so important. And it's a really good way for students to like kind of reestablish a land ethic when they move to a new place and to like really start to understand the land that they've moved to. And so through doing forest defense, we connect these issues on a local level, as well as there's so many great resources and there's such a great history of forest defense activism within Eugene that's really, really helped students connect to older populations of environmentalism and learn more tactics and advocacy work as well.
You mentioned as we were setting up this call that the University of Oregon Climate Justice League works with Cascadia Wildlands. That's great. How did you all get involved with the Cascadia Wildlands work?
Yeah, so basically Cascadia Wildlands, we meet with them regularly and we figure out what timber sales they're currently working on, and then we take the information they give us and we talk to the group and figure out which timber sale we specifically want to bring to campus to focus on. And then from there, we pick an area that we want to work on getting protected, and we run an entire campaign, which includes taking college students out to the area. It's typically BLM land, which is public land, so we really try and talk about the idea that this is like our land, and as a population of Oregon, like we should have access to it and be able to recreate it. And then we also talk about forest justice and like impacts of logging on rural communities and things like that. So Cascadia is like our point person. We do a lot of joint trips with them. And we work specifically with their grassroots organizer, Sam, who provides us with like a lot of knowledge and helps us organize our trips.
That's great. And what are these trips? What do you all do on these trips when you go out into the forest?
Yeah. So these timber sales can range from wanting to be clear cuts or wanting to do some thinning, or they just might want to do some harvest. And so with every sale, we're like learning more things. When we typically go out to the forest, we do this thing called field checking, which is basically where we go into the units that are designated to have some sort of logging. And we have a list of things that help protect the forest, which includes marbled murrelet habitat, like large legacy trees, streams and waterbeds, and these are the things that I'm mostly looking at. So then we can write really, really well-informed comments and also use our experiences to educate other people about these forests that might be in danger of being cut. Part of what we've seen is that when they are designating a forest to be cut, they're using processes, they're using aerial surveying. And so they're not on the ground looking at these areas. And they have a lot of pressure federally to be cutting down a lot of forests for economic reasons. And so a lot of the times they will bundle up a bunch of land into a sale. And then without people actually going and exploring this area, sometimes there will be parcels of forest or really, really important parts that are overlooked that they don't have the opportunity of seeing. And so Cascadia Wildlands really, really focuses on finding those areas, especially old forests. Or sometimes they will pick a forest and say, this forest needs to be thinned because it's been fire suppressed and we need to help protect, or this is going to be good for the overall health of the forest. And then we go in and we're like, no, this forest is actually extremely healthy. Or we'll find a couple of acres within a huge sale that should be protected. And we've had a lot of luck with communicating with the BLM once we have found these areas that we think shouldn't be cut down. They will go on hikes with us, they'll let us show them what we have found a lot of times. And so it's mostly just being on the ground, seeing what this forest is, filling in the gaps for what the BLM doesn't do.
That's great. So the Climate Justice League is a school club, I'm assuming. How do you all get students to get involved, and how do you get them excited about this really cool opportunity that you're offering?
Yes, so it is a school club. And something that we have found really successful is partnering with the OP program, which is the outdoor program at the University of Oregon. And what they try and do is get people outside. They have multiple vans and they do trips. And so what we have done is we have sponsored trips. And so then we had the biggest trip we had was 24 seats in a van. And these emails go out to everyone on the listserv at the university that has interest in going on trips outdoors, which is a really large population of the university. And so then they get this email being okay, there's a trip this weekend to go into a forest with the Climate Justice League. And we've had a lot of luck with meeting students that wouldn't normally come to our meetings and be involved in forest defense, but wanting to go outside or maybe being curious about the forestry in Oregon. And so that's the main process we've had a lot of luck with. And then it allows us to take large groups out, usually for really cheap, which helps students who wouldn't normally be able to access these areas have access to them and really understand the practices in place in Oregon around logging.
This seems like a really great opportunity to get connected to different organizations and people in the community.
Yeah, we definitely try and kind of build the relationship outside of the campus, because the University of Oregon is just kind of, it's really its own separate area that doesn't have, even though we have access to a lot of really great natural areas around it, including Henders Park, which is a segment of old growth forest, it's really good for students to be able to get off campus and get involved and meet different members of the community that aren't 18 to 25 years old. It can be really refreshing and just good for your overall health, I'd say.
Why does the Climate Justice League focus on climate justice? And maybe you could give us a definition of what is climate justice?
Yes. So climate justice is basically the idea that climate change is going to disproportionately affect populations due to the inequality that's around globally, nationally, as well as locally. And so trying to find where climate change is affecting our populations in general, or just things that overall contribute to climate change, because we're trying to directly show that within our organization we see the ties between social injustice and climate change, and that seems to be the forefront of what our club is trying to do. So that is why we have chosen that as the name, and try and make sure that all of our campaigns have a really strong tie to social justice, to really advocate for that intersectionality.
When was the club founded, and how do you all organize yourselves? How is it managed?
I think that we were founded in the early 2000s. So we are pretty, in context to the university, we're the oldest environmental club. But that's just because the university is constantly, like, the makeup and the types of clubs are, like, constantly changing. It's really where the student interest is. Because there's such a high turnover rate for the university, you know, every 4 years there's new people. You see the dynamics of clubs changing a lot. So, like, what climate justice might mean to the students in 4 to 8 years might be completely different than the way that we see it now. So I think that that's one of the really cool dynamics of student organizations. But it also can be really hard, because that's how clubs die very quickly and easily, is when you lose momentum through the students that are involved once they graduate. It's really hard to, like, maintain a club, as well as it maintain a mission. You see a lot of, like, mission drift, because, like, the bylaws and, like, missions written by one set of students might be completely different, or, like, might not even be read by the new set of students that become involved. So it creates its own interesting dynamic.
Yeah, that's excellent experience. We have that problem often in nonprofits and all sorts of organizations. That's great.
Totally, right. And I think that that's where the partnership with local nonprofits can really, really help, is because they've been there for a lot longer. And so then they can, like, kind of be a constant source of knowledge and a base for a student organization. And you see that a lot with Augsburg, which has a huge network, and they are, like, a campus club, but they also are a lot more than that. They're a huge advocacy nonprofit that works, like, I think nationally. And so that's the base for their club, which is a little bit different from Climate Justice League, which doesn't have a national base to a larger organization.
Do you all work with groups who are engaged in the Green New Deal, or what is your take on the Green New Deal, and how does it connect with your work with forests?
Right, yes. So we actually have just endorsed Doyle Canning. We had a vote, and we've been working on her campaign and contributing to the phone banking and canvassing for her campaign because of her work with the Green New Deal and her policies and endorsement of the Green New Deal. So we strongly believe that it's important. We also do a lot of organizational events and whatnot with Sunrise Eugene, which has a huge involvement with the Green New Deal. And so we don't directly do advocacy for the Green New Deal as our club, because we think that we, like, want to focus more on our campaign-specific missions, but we are in full support, and we work with other organizations due to their involvement with the Green New Deal.
What are some of the other projects or campaigns that the Climate Justice League is working on right now?
Yeah, so the other thing that we were organizing that recently got canceled because of COVID was an eco-grief panel for Earth Week. So that's something that our organization has started to talk about, is because we are, like, a student organization that does environmental work. There's kind of this new topic of conversation that's arising, feelings of grief over the environment being destroyed. And it's a very new kind of work, like it's just like a new concept being brought just due to, like, how fast the environment was being destroyed. And so we're trying to, like, be on top of all that data and learn it early, so we can, like, support people and, like, just be vocal about the fact that this is an emotional subject as well as, like, in the science environmental subject.
Wow, that's some really important discussion to have there. Super intense. What is the role of the Climate Justice League in helping people, you know, kind of work through some of that ecological grief? Or, you know, I can imagine going through the woods or doing these forest outings would be really helpful for that.
We actually were just talking the other day about how amazing it is for, like, the work that we do, is that we get to go into the forest and hike around and, like, see all of these really natural, beautiful places. And I think that, like, being able to do that and being able to do it with a group is just, like, a very powerful way to kind of cope with all of the environmental issues that are happening right now. Also, like, we go out into the forest and we share meals together and we eat lunch and we sing songs on the guitar. And I think just, like, having fun times while we're doing our work, like, within environmentalism, in the need for there to be, like, times which our community is bonding together and celebrating I think is really, really important. And the Climate Justice League has really, really tried to do that. We've done a lot of community events, whether that be potlucks, or like talent shows or canvassing, just things like that. We try and also just like hang out and be a good community basis.
So why forests? Why are y'all focusing on forests with the campaign that you're working on? And how does that connect to climate change and Oregon's response to addressing climate change? Forests. Why are they so important in Oregon?
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at a lot of the studies, I'm sure you're familiar, that come out of Oregon State, there's a lot of studies showing that the Pacific Northwest forests are some of the most powerful forests in the nation and in the world for sequestering carbon. They're actually essential to mitigating climate change. And so, like, ever more presently, it's just become so important to protect these forests while they're still here. And we're just seeing these forests getting logged at such a high rate. And it's pretty horrifying, given the fact that, like, we should, first of all, stop logging forests, and then we should also, like, be trying to create as many forest areas as possible. We also deal a lot with the miseducation around what logging industry usually says is, like, okay, we are constantly planting trees, replanting these areas, but we care about these forests. And not acknowledging the fact that old forests are scientifically proven to sequester more carbon. And that when you go in there and you log them and you build all these roads, that you're actually contributing to carbon. And another thing I think that's really, really important to note is that the logging industry in Oregon is the number one carbon emitter of the state. And so it's really directly tied to climate change.
Yeah, those studies are super important and really interesting regarding how excellent our forests here are in the Pacific Northwest for storing carbon. And it gets me thinking, you know, how do we do this type of work at the Coast Range Association, is how do we work with rural people and rural communities, and how do we provide for people's livelihoods in the forests while taking care of forests and managing them in an appropriate way, and looking at, how these large, timber companies are managing forests compared to what could be done.
I mean, I think it's really important to understand that that there is proper forest management, and that we are being, like, as sustainable as possible within our logging conversations. Right now, I think something that Climate Justice League has come across is there's this huge social and political divide between environmentalists and rural logging communities. We really, really, really recently had an experience where we attended the Oregon Logging Conference, where a climate denier was speaking. He was the keynote speaker, Patrick Moore, who says over and over and over again that carbon is actually good for humans, that it's like the life force of everything, and that more carbon's not going to hurt anyone. And we decided to, like, show up and interrupt his speech based on the premise that, like, this is, like, misinformation and miseducation being spoken at a logging conference. And, like, logging needs to be educated about, like, sustainability. And there's a lot of, like, logging companies that are beginning to talk about sustainability and the right ways to log, and having a climate denier speak is just going backwards in our ability to deal with climate change. And so we decided to come interrupt, and it went really, really badly. We were treated really, really awfully, and we felt bad as well, because it didn't turn into, like, okay, we wanted it to kind of be this silly thing where we are pointing out that what this guy was saying was obviously idiot. Like, was just based off of lies and misinformation. But it just turned into, like, immediate hate. As soon as we were identified as environmentalists, there was, like, a lot of physical brutality, and we were, like, physically taken out of the conference. And it was just really interesting, because for students, you know, they're learning in their classrooms about sustainability and proper forest management, and we talked about climate denying and it seems like climate denial is in the past. Like, we've all kind of thought that we've moved on past that. So it was a really, really weird experience to kind of see this information being given out to, like, the logging industry and, like, families of the logging industry at whole, and being endorsed by the Oregon Logging Conference. And then also not just being endorsed, but being, like, violently protected, was also a really, really weird understanding. So I think that what we are trying to move forward is, like, effective ways of kind of building those bridges with the logging industry and families that are from logging backgrounds, so that we can, like, move forward. And I think that's what's so great about the Green New Deal, is it really, really talks about like, working families and making sure that there's protection in the economy as we move to more sustainable practices. And so just, like, trying to communicate and say, like, you know, we're not trying to take your jobs away. We're not trying to harm your families. I know that we are always just, like, pointing out that, like, that's bad for the environment. Please don't do that. But, like, we're trying to do this for the good of all of us. And that, like, it's not, like, we're not your enemy. Because it, at this point in time, it really does feel that way.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the work that the Coast Range Association does. And we've done, the director, Chuck Willer, has done some really excellent research regarding Wall Street Forestry. The program's called Challenging Wall Street Forestry, and researching, you know, changes in ownership, changes to different type management companies, timber investment management organizations, and real estate investment trusts, these types of businesses or organizations that basically manage the forests for financial for the benefit of their shareholders, and nothing to do, they don't manage them in any way for ecological reasons. And, you know, there's even studies showing that the way that they're being these forests are being managed by these organizations, they're actually reducing the amount of board feet that could be. So it's not even based on, you know, the amount of production. It's truly based on the growth of money and the growth of these forests, and competing with compound interest and the growth of growth of money. So it's, yeah, it's really interesting, and it has a huge impact on the forests, has a huge impact on rural communities, impacts on, you know, local and state taxes, you know, resources for communities to help take care of themselves. So yeah, we'd be happy to share some of that research with y'all. And yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I think that we'll definitely have to look into that research. We're trying to build kind of this canvassing script and model so that we can kind of start trying to talk to more rural families and kind of find some common ground. I think that seems like a very good point of research to look at as well.
Great. So how do folks get involved with your work, or how do folks, you know, get involved in this work and continue to learn about this, or get out into the woods, or yeah, what are some recommendations you have for folks?
Yeah, so I also think one of the basic things that you can do is go field checking, and Cascadia Wildlands hosts monthly public field checking, and Climate Justice League always has a really strong presence there, and we try and bring as many students as possible. And part of that is building relationships with the community and students, trying to do the same mission. And you can always find that on Cascadia Wildlands. Field checking is in dispersed small groups in the forest that we're going to continue doing them as of now amid the virus. So this might be a really, really good way to, like, go out and do something, but also stay safe and practice social distancing, and also be able to connect to nature. And so we're hoping to maybe do some increased field checking and take students out as well, because all of their classes are moved online. So there's going to be, I think, a lot of restlessness and wanting to get out. But that's just going to be based on the way that things progress. But we're hoping that might be a good way to continue our work. If you want to stay updated on Climate Justice League and the things that we're doing, our email is climatejusticeleague@gmail.com. And then all of our Instagram and Facebook is just the Climate Justice League. So that's a really good way to stay updated with what we're doing.
Well, awesome. Courtney, thank you so much for taking the time to interview with Coast Range Radio. Really appreciate it, and really appreciate all the great work that you're doing. Keep it up, and look forward to hearing more about it in the future. And thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for interviewing us. I think this is your organization, The Coast Range, seems like a great basis and another good resource that Climate Justice League could work with.
Awesome. Great. Thanks. Take care. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay well, stay healthy. We'll talk to you soon.
We're in Portland, we always try to put in at least 5 or 6 hours at Cable,
right.
Because we're
the Fire Sign Theater.
So listen to 90.7 FM for...
You are listening to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Located in Western Oregon, the Coast Range Association works to build just and sustainable communities that provide for people and the natural world. Our work focuses on the connections between Oregon's forests, communities, and the climate crisis. To hear past episodes and to learn more, visit coastrange.org. Please support your local radio station. Each station provides essential local and regional news and entertainment that can't be found anywhere else. The Coast Range Association stands with all Black, Indigenous, and other people of color in their communities as we fight for justice in this unprecedented time. We continue to advocate for a Green New Deal and a just transition to a society that works for all people. All of our struggles are interconnected. As we come together to support each other as one movement for justice, our power continues to grow. It is time to get active and to stay involved. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Andrea Rogers, senior attorney at Our Children's Trust. We discuss environmental law in the age of coronavirus and the nonprofit public interest law firm, Our Children's Trust. Andrea then provides updates from the climate justice case, Juliana versus United States. You're listening to Coast Range Radio. My name is Andrew Collins Anderson, and I hope everyone's doing well out there. This is another at-home version of Coast Range Radio. We're here at home doing a Zoom interview, or over the internet, we're doing an interview. I'm here speaking with Andrea Rogers, who is the senior attorney at Our Children's Trust, where she serves as co-counsel on the constitutional youth climate lawsuit against the federal government, Juliana versus United States, and as lead counsel on the constitutional youth climate lawsuit against the state of Washington, AHI versus state of Washington, in the state of Florida, Reynolds versus state of Florida. She has served as an honors attorney for the U.S. Department of Transportation, in-house legal counsel for the Snoqualmie Indian Tribe, and staff attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center. Her environmental law practice focused on reducing pollution from industrial agricultural operations, protecting and enhancing in-stream flows for people and fish, and fighting climate change on behalf of young people and future generations. Andrea is licensed to practice law in Washington and Oregon and is admitted to practice in the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and Tenth Circuit U.S. District Courts for the Eastern and Western Districts of Washington, Oregon, Montana, and Northern California, the Snoqualmie Tribal Court, the Lami Indian Nation Tribal Court, and the Muckleshoot Tribal Court. Hey, Andrea, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
And
thank you.
Any of my pronunciations I pronounced wrong, if you could fix those for me, that I'd appreciate
it. It's a Lummi Tribal Lummi. Court. That was the only one. Yeah,
Lummi. Lummi. Nice. Great. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for your great work and your work at Our Children's Trust. And I was hoping maybe just at the top here, we could talk a little bit about your experience in the field of environmental law and what's happening right now during the COVID-19 pandemic and what are things on hold? What's the current situation? And maybe gives our listeners a little bit of insight with some of these really important projects that you're working on.
Yeah, well, you know, fortunately, we're very fortunate. A lot of our work goes on. You know, all of our team is able to work digitally. So we're continuing to prosecute our cases as best we can. In the legal world, you know, a lot of deadlines have been pushed back. Many courts are closed, but work is still going forward. It's just, I would envision this is, you know, quite a bit of a delay that we're experiencing. We have had two of our oral arguments have been canceled because of COVID-19. Wow. So we were supposed to argue in the Washington Court of Appeals in the Piper versus State of Washington case on April 6th, and that was canceled. We were supposed to argue on April 21st in the Reynolds versus State of Florida case. And that case was actually interesting because the parties in the court had agreed to have the oral argument via Zoom. Wow. So we were preparing for that, but ultimately the court decided they wanted the hearing in person and rescheduled it to June 1st, which I still don't know if that's gonna be feasible to have an in-person hearing at that time. So many lawyers are working with and educating judges really about how do you hold hearings over Zoom and how do you have these electronic arguments. And even the Supreme Court just this week has issued an order. They're going to be having telephonic arguments for the first time ever. So for many judges, this is a whole new world. Some are very eager to get make sure that justice is moving forward. And so they're willing to embrace these new this new technology to make sure that cases can move forward. It's probably most difficult in the criminal realm. Many judges, many courts have made the findings that they need to find in order to declare emergencies because there's speedy trial issues and things like that. Mm. But many changes have happened quickly, but legal cases are still going forward.
Wow. There must be some serious challenges to that, having to do a digital argument and getting your point across. That seems like a new skill set to be.
It is, because when you argue in front of a judge, it's so important to connect with the judge, and you can see, you know, their reactions. You can, you know, there's just there's just a different energy.
Yeah.
And when you're on Zoom, that energy just does not come through,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
So it's very challenging, and it's a reality that many of us around the world are trying to deal with. I was invited to speak to do a keynote at a conference at Tulane University at the beginning of March, and my team made the wise decision not to send me there in person. And so I ended up doing the keynote over Zoom.
Wow.
But it's so hard to do that because you can't see the audience. So I had my dad sit across the table from me.
Nice.
So I at least was speaking to a human. So, you've got to do that. Actually helps, you know, so you have your sort of straw man in there.
Uh-huh.
So,
oh, that's great.
Lawyers probably do it. And, you know, there was another funny article that came out recently. A judge in Florida issued a letter or something reminding the lawyers who appear before him over Zoom to at least wear a shirt. he said he'd gotten lawyers appearing over Zoom. They didn't have shirts on. One woman looked like she was still in her pajamas in bed.
Wow.
So he had to issue a statement reminding attorneys to get dressed. So
that's funny.
If you see someone walking around in a suit instead of their pajamas or a leisure suit, I think you can assume they're appearing in court that day.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I try to at least when I'm doing stuff like this, I try to put on a shirt and make sure I'm feeling like I'm going into the office or something like that. That's important.
Oh, totally. And yeah. I have two kids that I'm, now homeschooling. Wow. In effect, they're 8 and 12, but yeah, routine is really, really important, you know, and
yes,
that's sort of what's gotten us through is, creating our own school schedule and, sticking to that so that we can at least try to get our work done when we need to. But we're all in the same boat. It's challenging on many levels. I think the one, we've had beautiful weather. I'm in Seattle, you're in Eugene. It's been remarkable. And I think the one positive is the respite that Mother Earth has been getting in these last few weeks since things have really shut down. This is never how you want to restore the health of our planet, but I think seeing people out and enjoying the beautiful nature that we have, it's become a vital aspect of our survival at this point in time, being locked in. So I think it's been a very nice reminder. And I don't know what my family would do without our walks on the beach and, through the neighborhood and seeing the birds and the flowers. And it's been quite tremendous. And hearing the stories, the canals of Venice are clean once again. And
definitely.
It's really interesting, and I think the hope is that once we get through this, we'll really be able to create a society that treats our planet Earth with a little bit more respect than we were doing previously.
I think I totally agree with that, and I think that it's going to be an interesting, probably gives us a little bit of an insight to, we can slow down a little bit, and there's are things that we can do, and even just with the stimulus, trying to help people, we can say like, oh, look at, there's, we can actually invest in people and workers and the environment, and there's a way to do that. And it's kind of showing what a Green New Deal could potentially do for our societies and moving into the future with a lot of unknowns and
And I think we are going to have to be rebuilding many aspects of our society because we are shutting down so much and so many people are suffering. So I think there'll be some very important fundamental questions. How do we want to rebuild as a society? And I think what's with our work, what's really exciting, we work with energy experts who've done the work to show that, we can decarbonize our energy system in a way that, we wouldn't be paying any more than we've been paying for fossil fuel energy system. So the solutions are out there. It's just a matter of committing to getting it done. And the other thing that we've really seen to the parallel and what we've been going through is how important planning is, right?
Like
planning for a pandemic. What if our schools had planned for the closures so that they actually knew what kids had technology, what kids didn't have technology, so they can get up and running if we had these plans in place. And that's what we seek in our lawsuits. We seek essentially climate recovery plans. So court orders requiring the governments to figure out and plan, how do you decarbonize the energy system? Because some of the climate impacts we're going to start seeing, we're even seeing them today in terms of hurricanes and other extreme weather events. They happen rapidly. And we haven't seen anything like COVID, of course, but those kinds of changes are happening and they're happening even more quickly. So we really need to do that kind of mass planning to make sure that we're prepared.
In listening to scientists. Yeah, that's so
exactly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So that gets me to my question here. So you work for a group called the Our Children's Trust. For folks who've never heard of that organization, could you give us a little outline of what is the Our Children's Trust?
Sure. We're a nonprofit law firm. We're based in Eugene, Oregon. And we represent young people in constitutional cases against their governments. We are seeking science-based remedies. So We ask the scientists the question, you know, what's needed to restore the climate system? And that's a fairly straightforward scientific answer once you take politics out of it. And we're asking that courts apply that science, those scientific standards, to when they review the government conduct in pursuing their energy systems and in implementing their energy systems. So, you know, we have cases around the world. Our largest case is Juliana versus United States, in which we represent 21 young people around the United States against the United States federal government. We have cases against state governments, and we also represent 15 youth in a case against Her Majesty the Queen in Canada. That's called the LaRose case. Those are 15 young Canadians who are tremendously impacted by climate change. You know, and climate change really isn't a political issue. It's a scientific issue, right? It's a scientific phenomenon. And unfortunately, you know, courts have largely failed to hold governments accountable for their conduct in causing and contributing to climate change. And that's what our cases are all about. And I think one of the things we have seen with the COVID crisis is the role of government in our daily life is pretty significant in terms of the systems that we rely upon.
Yeah.
And governments play a very strong role in how we get our energy. You know, they plan for it, they subsidize it, they permit it. And unfortunately, what they've been focused on is fossil fuel sources of energy. And so we're trying to get the courts to recognize that the effects of that is harming our children, and that courts need to step in and require the governments to get into constitutional compliance. We've been very fortunate. The community in Eugene has been tremendously supportive and inspiring. And, you know, they've really stepped up to support these young people. You know, the young plaintiffs that we've been representing, you know, they've been climate activists for large portions of their lives. And they were doing it, you know, before people like Greta Thunberg were out there, you know, getting national and global coverage. So it's really exciting to see how the youth climate movement has just exploded and really getting the recognition and the work that the young people are doing in terms of organizing and getting their message heard is really, really exciting. And we're honored to be able to provide them with legal representation in cases against their governments, because many of them can't vote.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's super inspiring, seeing the mobilization and the youth movement really just taking off. Really gives us at the Coast Range Association a lot of inspiration. And we've actually done several interviews with folks at different levels at Sunrise and other climate organizations and movements that have been really inspiring and awesome. So
yep.
Thank you for your work in supporting those folks and those kids, you know, in their efforts. So maybe you could go into a little bit with Juliana versus the United States and the recent ruling that happened. I'm forgetting the date off the top of my head, but
yeah,
maybe.
Well, yeah. On January 17th, we got, you know, the case was filed in 2015. So we have been up and down and backward and forward for many years, even up to the Supreme Court a couple of times on some procedural issues. But on January 17th of this year, a divided panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit issued a decision in our case. And in that case, they recognized that the young people were injured, suffered by climate change, that the federal government was a substantial factor in causing their injuries. But two of the three judges ruled that there's just simply nothing a federal court can do to remedy the plaintiff's injuries. And, you know, it's a remarkable ruling in many ways. It starts out with the judge who wrote the decision, Judge Andrew Hurwitz, on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He quotes a song from the 60s called The Eve of Destruction. And so he recognizes, you know, the existential nature of the crisis that these young people are facing. But he plainly says, you know, he doesn't think there's a role for the courts in resolving this crisis, even when the government is purposefully and knowingly harming its own children. So there's a very strong dissenting opinion by District Judge Staten out of Central District of California. And in it, she recognizes, you know, that the conduct of the government is essentially destroying our nation. And she believes that the young people have a right to present their evidence at trial. You know, what's unique about our case is it's in a very early procedural posture, even though we've been going on for a long time, because the government has put up many, many roadblocks, many procedural challenges throughout the life of the case. But we've not yet been able to present our evidence in a court of law. And so many of the questions that I think that the majority struggled with would have been easier for them to resolve had they had a fully developed trial record. And that's what we're hoping to develop, because we recognize these issues are of significance and importance, and higher courts generally want to have a fully developed factual record. So experts testifying at trial about what can be done to remedy the climate crisis, that kind of evidence they need to hear from at the district court level before it should go up on appeal. So in light of that decision, we filed what's called a petition for review en banc. And so we are asking the full Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to review the case. And they can either decline to review it, and in that case, the panel's decision dismissing the case would stand, or they can accept en banc review. And we would either do additional briefing, we could have additional oral argument, and then 14 judges on the Court of Appeals would hear and decide the case. And then depending on which way the Ninth Circuit goes, we'll have to make a decision as to whether we want to go or up to the United States Supreme Court, which will be, you know, a very, you know, we will think very hard about whether that's the right thing to do with this case.
Wow. Wow. That's some excellent information. A term that I don't understand, en banc.
En banc, that just means the full court.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. Okay.
So we got the original case was heard by a three-judge panel. Okay. And then, so we're able to ask the full court to review the case, which would then overrule the decision of the three-judge panel if they were to grant en banc review. So we filed that petition on March 2nd. The government has responded. And so we're at this point just waiting to see what the court will do. You know, we hope to have a decision in the next few months. It's very difficult to guess when that will be, particularly in light of COVID. You know, things are just taking longer than they typically would.
Well, and it sounds like this case has taken longer than it typically would all the way through. And what is your assessment of that, and is there ways to, you know, in the future get past some of those roadblocks that have, you know?
I you know, if I had the answer to that question, you know, that that's the question, right? Here we have evidence from our experts saying, you know, this is the most urgent issue on the planet. You know, if we don't take action now, we are going to be falling off a cliff. You know, these young people will not be able to potentially survive the kinds of impacts that we're anticipating. So when you look at the expert evidence, you're really floored in terms of the recognition of the urgency and the need to change course and to change and to decarbonize our energy system. But then when you look at how the court system handles climate change cases have been filed over for the last 40 years. And not, you know, to very little success. So what's the disconnect there? You know, I think a lot of it was, you know, the considering this to be a political issue, right? That this is something legislative or executive branches should handle. So, you know, that's why we've framed our case in the way that we have, because the legislative and the executive branch, they can certainly take action on climate change, but what they can't do is purposefully create and implement a system that violates the constitutional rights of our youngest citizens. So, and that should be an issue that is judicially reviewable and that courts can issue a remedy. And a good example of that is look at Brown versus Board of Education. You know, in that case, the youth brought constitutional claims against the government who were sanctioning segregation in public schools. And the court ruled that that violates equal protection of the law. And then they ordered the states to come up with plans to fix it. And there's still, you know, it's taken many, many years. And you still see the results of segregation today in our school systems. But unfortunately, with climate, you know, that even those kind of initial planning hasn't happened in many jurisdictions. So, you know, that's what our cases are really all about, is to try to get that get government accountable for their role in causing and contributing to climate change.
Nice. It's something I really appreciate, the movement moving more and more towards a justice component as far as drawing those parallels between climate change and environmental justice and social justice. And sounds like that's a huge piece of this conversation here.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're constantly reminding people that climate change is not an environmental issue. I wish I could say with pride that this is an environmental case, because I strongly believe that we should have pride in environmental values. But unfortunately for much of the world, that's just not the case. It is what it is. But, you know, our case at its heart is really a constitutional and a civil rights case, you know, because it's about children and how their lives and development are being negatively affected by the choices that their political leaders are making. And the political leaders are making these choices, even though they have the information in front of them saying the choices you're making harm children. You know, we have a vast amount of evidence of government documents recognizing that climate change would disproportionately impact youth for decades, you know, so it's not something that they're not aware of. They're aware of the effects of their actions, yet they continue. And I think that's a perfect example of when courts need to intervene.
Really important point there. So I want to let folks know, how do folks support Our Children's Trust to support your work? How do they find the work that you do? And how can people get involved? What's a great way for folks to engage with this?
Yeah, well, we're a nonprofit law firm and we have a website, ourchildrenstrust.org. And we're very fortunate to have a great base of individual donors. We also have an army of volunteers that support us in a bunch of different ways. We work with a tremendous number of legal volunteers, and law students have been a tremendous asset to our team over the years, and volunteers in our office, outside our office. And then there's also many opportunities to support these young people. You know, it's very difficult to be a young person today. I think the COVID crisis just has added another layer by taking school away from them, another layer of the difficulties that they face in being young people. But the young people that we represent, they've stepped up to become leaders and have shared their stories. And there's many ways that you can support these young people, whether it's by coming out to hearings to support them. And I don't know what that will look like in the new era. We'll have a bunch of online support and we'll be rolling out some additional content. Our youth have been busy working on different things to share their stories and to let people know how they're doing and what they're doing in this age of the COVID crisis. So stay tuned for that. We'll start coming out on our website and our Instagram feed and in all of those different platforms as well.
Yeah, so everyone go and follow Our Children's Trust, go visit their website, support them, volunteer, support the youth activists. And Andrea, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us at Coast Range Radio. Thank you so much for all the great work that you're doing. And be well and stay healthy, and getting outside, so important, and taking care of yourself while you're doing this really important work. Thank you so much.
And thank you for protecting our Coast Range. I can't think of a bit more beautiful place. So thank you for all your work.
Yeah, we're all trying to play a role in this new society that we're building. So thanks everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voting.